Okay, in this paper, first of all, I'm going to give an overview of the global broiler or meat chicken industry. That's what, in case any of you are unaware, that's what broiler means. It means meat chicken. So I'm going to give an overview of the industry, the current state of affairs in the UK and New Zealand, and also a kind of overview of the welfare impacts on animals. I'm then going to give a summary of my main analytical tool, which I'm using to describe and explain these policy processes, which is called policy network analysis. I'll then trace the development of UK broiler welfare policy and also New Zealand policy in that area, and then I'll finish with the discussion. This research I'm doing is actually part of a brand new research project that we're initiating at the Centre for Animals and Social Justice, which is in the broad field of animals, democracy and representation. So one of our first tasks is to really analyse the situation in terms of what is happening to animals, why it's happening in terms of the kind of political forces, and how comparing what actually happens to animals with sort of where public opinion is and where the law is, and looking at the issues of ethical and democratic legitimacy. And I should also point out that I'm a co-founder of the Centre for Animals and Social Justice together with my partner and colleague Angela Roberts as well, so it's important to bear that in mind. Okay, look at the UK broiler industry first actually. In the UK, the production of broilers, it's currently at 873 million animals per year, chickens per year are killed. The numbers have been fluctuating a bit over recent years. They dipped down to just under 800 million in 2008, but so they've gone back up to 873 now. So that's a huge number of animals. And I don't know if any of you have read my abstract. The number of broilers killed, the number of individual animals used in this area, dwarfs every single other area of animal farming. And as we see, not just in scale, as we'll see in a second. Now, the basic UK industry standard method is called assured chicken production, which is marketed under the Red Tractor Scheme. This involves flocks of up to 50,000 birds or more in houses with controlled temperature, light and ventilation. So that's a pretty classic example of a broiler shed towards the end of the growing period. So yeah, there's flocks of 50,000 birds or more in houses with controlled temperature, light and ventilation. There's litter on the floor, and often the houses are windowless, as you've seen. The broilers are a fast growth breeds and are fed nutrient dense diets, including things like sort of synthetic amino acids and genetically modified ingredients. It's a very industrialised artificial process. Now, they're grown indoors at stocking densities of about 17 to 20 birds per square metre, which is quite a few, as you can imagine. And these days, they're actually slaughtered. The kind of final slaughter weight is reached sometimes as early as 35 days. Now, however, the proportion, that's the standard, the industry standard approach. However, the proportion of animals raised at this assured sort of level dropped from 96% to 79% between 2005 and 2009, with the proportion of chickens raised under various higher standards increasing, though most of these are in systems that are only marginally better than the ACP, rather than being more genuinely free-range or organic. It's also worth bearing in mind that approximately 20% of chicken eaten in the UK has been imported, with Thailand supplying about half of those imports. And if we're trying to look at UK policy on this and our impacts on these animals, we've got to take into account not just our production but our consumption as well. Not that I'm going to actually go into too much detail on this at the moment. Okay, New Zealand. One of the reasons I've chosen New Zealand as a comparison is that in some ways it's quite close to the UK, and sometimes that can prove quite a useful comparison, because if you do see differences, it's easier to perhaps identify the reasons for that. But also it's quite different, it's completely opposite side of the world, the population, even though the land area is similar to the UK, is actually only 4.5 million, so it's much less densely populated. It's a very similar population to the Republic of Ireland, actually. And as I'll say later, that can have an impact on political processes as well. Now, in New Zealand, around 85 million chickens are slaughtered every year. New Zealand has a slightly higher number of broilers per capita than the UK, that means, very slightly. And another interesting thing about New Zealand is that the industry there is far more oligopolistic compared to the UK. There's only four major producers, whereas the UK industry is a bit more disparate and diverse. Now, according to the Royal New Zealand Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, only 5% of New Zealand broiler chickens were free range in 2009, although apparently the two largest producers have just joined their accreditation scheme, which is called the Blue Tick. So they're expecting the numbers to go up in the next few years. However, there are significant differences as well between the New Zealand and the UK definitions of free range, which I'll talk about in more detail shortly. Now, on the issue of the kind of broad welfare problems, now this is drawn from a number of major studies. There was a big scientific study done by the European Commission in 2000. A new study of welfare risks was published about 2 years ago by the European Food Standards Agency, who happened to do a lot of animal welfare assessment work as well. And funny enough, I looked at this issue for my dissertation as an undergraduate 21 years ago. And the sad thing is, if anything, things have got worse since then, even though quite a bit of my research then was based on a Horizon program, which really sort of, it was called Fast Life in the Food Chain, and it focused on broiler chickens and dairy cows as an example of how modern production techniques were putting so much stress on animals. And it's a shame that, in a sense, despite growing awareness of what's been happening, nothing's really changed for these animals, and we'll explain more about that later. So, yeah, hens are... Well, actually, the broiler chickens are derived from an animal called the jungle fowl. I think the Latin name is Gallus gallus. But then the hens, they retain modern sort of chickens that are used in industry, they still retain a lot of the behavioural needs of jungle fowl. They're naturally inquisitive animals with a strong desire to perch, preen themselves, dust bathe, forage and nest. But unfortunately, compared with other animal farming methods, intensive broiler chicken production is the most removed from the natural environment of the progenitors of the modern commercial animal. Now, a number of factors combine to cause pain, suffering and distress to chickens in the dominant intensive systems. But there are two particularly critical inputs I want to focus on today, and that's genotype and stocking density. Now, on the question of genotype, meat chickens have been continuously genetically selected to grow very quickly. So the time from when the birds first hatch to appearing on the supermarket shelves can be as little as 5 weeks, as I've just mentioned. And this is just to give you an example. The bird nearest us is a layer, and obviously the white one is a broiler. They're both the same age. I think they're about 4 to 5 weeks old. But that gives you an example of the way broiler chickens have been so intensively bred over the last 50 years, actually, to give such a massive difference in growth rate. So these growth rates contribute not only to the most severe, but also the majority of the welfare problems seen in today's chickens. And chickens of such fast-growing genotypes are vulnerable to a range of serious ailments, because basically their legs, their hearts and their lungs do not develop quickly enough to support the massive muscle growth. And for example, the rapid growth can contribute to a variety of leg problems, ascites, which is a heart and circulatory problem caused by the heart cannot process the blood quickly enough. The blood gets backed up in the system and fluid leaks into the abdomen. It's also known as dropsy, I think. And also, relatedly, they suffer congestive heart failure, and it's actually called sudden death syndrome, but that's basically a euphemism for a heart attack. And these are in birds literally just a few weeks old. Now, fast-growing chickens, because of these problems, they spend more time sitting on the floor and less time on perches. They spend less time walking and scratching compared to with slow grow chickens. And that exacerbates the leg problems because they're not getting any exercise really. And from what I can glean, the mortality rates per day at least for the fast growing chickens are a lot higher than the slow growing birds. And the net effect is that the industry has created a bird which is a non-survivor. For example, if any of these birds were fortunate enough to be rescued and allowed to live naturally, they would usually not survive past their first birthday due to their poor genetic disposition. An estimated 25% of these animals, so that we're talking probably over 200 million in the UK alone, they suffer significant lameness. Basically, that's worked out this thing called the gait score, where observers will score the animal, the chickens, in terms of how badly they're walking. And the from three is significant abnormality and is causing obvious distress. And so 25% are at that level or even worse, basically. And so one famous vet, Professor John Webster at Bristol, said that this lameness alone that they're suffering, it means this adverse effect renders intensive broiler production as the single most severe systematic example of our species' inhumanity towards other animals. And ironically, given the title of this conference, it's when the birds they're at the point where they can only move with great difficulty that they actually start to use their wings then to balance, which is a bit of a sad irony. And these birds are visibly distressed, and at this stage they also have problems in reaching food and water, which obviously then causes dehydration and starvation, and that contributes to the mortality rate. So another aspect of this is that while I was looking at this, I was actually quite a bit embarrassed because I found a whole sort of sector or aspect of this industry about which I was ignorant beforehand. Basically, the broiler industry works, and it makes perfect sense when you think about it. They have to have a separate breeding flock in order to produce the eggs, which are going to be actually brought up in the sheds and killed for the meat at 35, 42 days. But there's a fundamental problem here, though, because of the genotypes, they grow so quickly that they would actually struggle, these birds would struggle, the breeders would struggle to survive to sexual maturity, which takes three or four times longer than the sort of 35 to 42 day slaughter weight period. So these female breeders, if they were permitted to feed as they wanted to, obviously their welfare would be seriously undermined by heart problems and lameness. And also obviously their commercial utility would be undermined by high mortality rates, because obviously egg production, etc., would be very poor. So in an attempt to reduce these problems, the companies, the industry, feeds them a half or even less, sometimes only 20% of what they would normally eat given the chance. Now, whilst this is effective in reducing the incidence of health and welfare problems arising from the growth rates, on the other hand, it's a serious welfare concern because what they've found is that the birds are chronically hungry. So there is a constant element of stress and distress there that the animals are experiencing. On the issue of stocking density, increasing stocking density from even relatively low levels leads to deterioration in walking ability. As I've said, in the UK, that's typically 17 to 20 birds per metre, especially towards, I'll explain later, but especially kind of towards the end of the process. And also what they tend to do is overstock. And then at 3 weeks, they'll do something called thinning, which is a rather nasty euphemism for killing a proportion of the birds to fulfill a market for smaller birds. So particularly towards those two points, the stocking densities get very high. And that's equivalent to less than one A4 sheet of paper per chicken. And the high stocking density also has the potential to affect both the link between the environment and the welfare and the cognitive responses to other birds, because litter quality deteriorates with higher amounts of feces and high ammonia concentrates, and that causes problems with burns on the legs and abdomen and also respiratory issues. They also end up interacting more frequently with other birds, increasing stress, and it's harder for them to establish a pecking order and maintain that, and you'll get more basically more aggro within the flock. Opportunities to perform natural behaviours such as wing flapping are diminished, locomotion and exploration are inhibited, predisposing birds to contract contact dermatitis, and they spend longer time sleeping and congregating around the feeders, and they become more fearful. So there's an example of a bird where the weight has, the legs can't support their weight, basically they can't walk. So this bird's probably going to be in serious trouble with dehydration and starvation, amongst other things. Okay, now to the politics. So I'm going to analyse the sort of the politics of this by using a tool called policy network analysis. Now it's an orthodox established tool of political science, and what it does, it takes the interactions between interest groups and state actors in a particular policy sector as the starting point for trying to understand how policy is made, why the outcomes are as they are, who those outcomes favour, etc. Now the ontological core of this method is the idea that groups and state actors deploy their resources within the policy sector or network in order to achieve their policy goals and hence further their interests or cause. So we have to identify the resources, belief systems and actions of relevant groups over time. Also, we need to look at that in relation to the actual policy outcomes as well to understand how power is exercised. Now through analysis of key characteristics such as membership, patterns of outcomes, etc., policy networks can be positioned on a spectrum. At one end, networks with a broad membership, fluctuating access, distant state group relationships and high levels of conflict will tend to produce outcomes that fluctuate and do not consistently favour one set of interests. And these are known as issue networks. And they're associated with a pluralist model of power, where power is relatively evenly distributed rather than concentrated in the hands of a few. At the other end of the spectrum, you have networks with exclusive membership, close relationships and integration between the state and certain group members, and a consensus within that policy-making community. And these are known as policy communities. And they tend to produce outcomes that consistently favour the insider groups to the expense of excluded groups. Now, obviously, this reflects an elitist model of power, where it's concentrated amongst a certain subset of stakeholders while others are effectively excluded. Now, looking at this through the lens of regulatory theory, this would tend to describe a policy area where regulatory capture has taken place, i.e. where a formally regulated industry comes to dictate the terms of their own regulation instead of the public regulatory bodies. I mean, banking is a classic example in recent history. And I think also going back to BSC, that was another, really that was an outcome of the fact that the farming industry came to regulate itself, which is quite scary given that's the direction we're going in again, but no one seems to have learned the lessons from 20 to 30 years ago. So how do we, one of the things we have to do is we have to define the policy network and determine who's a member. Now to do this, we can't simply read lists of consultees or membership of advisory committees. That's a fundamentally inadequate approach because it says very little about degrees of power or influence, which are the essential factor in categorising networks. And in fact, the incorporation of cause groups into formal policymaking procedures is a classic tactic to increase the legitimacy of those processes without necessarily really changing them. And this happens when cause groups are consulted but kept away from the actual critical policy decisions. So in fact, in reality, they're not really given any influence or considered as serious players. Now these groups are known as peripheral insiders, so they're not genuine insider groups in the network. Now testing for genuine network membership requires close study of the evolution of a network to understand who the outcomes favour over time, and hence the consistent power of patterns of power distribution. I think the other thing to bear in mind is that policy networks are a kind of meso level of analysis. But in order to understand what's going on at the policy network level, you have to understand the two other levels. So first of all, above it, you've got macro level, which are the wider external factors, such as broader patterns of power, state imperatives. For example, probably one of the biggest state imperatives that you come across is the perceptions of what's economically or seen as necessary for maintain a certain position in the economy. Public opinion is another kind of external factor as well. And also hierarchically dominant policy networks. So for example, most policy networks in the UK are subsidiary to the Treasury, because the Treasury holds the purse strings and actually makes up the rules in something called the Green Book, which the departments have to use when they're formulating policy. So you've got the macro level there, policy networks there, and underneath you've got the micro level. And this is this kind of corresponds with individual agency, constrained as it is. But the thing is, the skills and resources of individuals and groups involved can potentially affect the network and its policy outcomes. But obviously the degree of power and autonomy that a group has to kind of act within the network, to some extent will be influenced by the history of the network and also the broader patterns of distribution. So for example, you know, industry groups tend to have a lot more leeway and room for manoeuvring policy networks compared to cause groups. And the other thing to bear in mind is that this is we have to look at this in a kind of dialectical or iterative way. So understanding the way that the different levels interact, and then, and also understand within that that within a kind of chronological basis to try and trace the way the policy networks and policies evolve over time. And this is consistent with the historical institutionalist method, and it's crucial insight that policy making is path dependent. Not path determined, but path dependent, in other words, its influence. In particular, critical junctures such as new legislation, where power relationships become institutionalised, will tend to influence the future trajectory of that network. Okay, now I'll start to sort of talk about in broad terms, the evolution of the UK broader policy. And now, it's a subset of general farm animal welfare policy. And one of the kind of seminal pieces of work in this area was something called the Bramble Report, which is almost 50 years old now, which looked into, which addressed concerns at the time about the growing industrialisation of animal agriculture. Now, reviewing that in 2009, the Advisory Committee of the Farm Animal Welfare Council, this kind of advises DEFRA ministers on these issues. Now, they claim that there's been insufficient progress in the resolution of lingering problems of poor welfare, such as lameness in dairy cows and broiler chickens. So even in 1965, what was happening to broiler chickens was being picked up by the Bramble Report. Now, what I'm actually going to do is kind of focus on the period of history I'm going to cover is going to cover two different governments. Because obviously, change in government is one of the things that can affect a policy network. So by sort of seeing how things happen or don't happen, that will also give us an insight into the nature of the policy network. Now, first I want to analyse the judicial review that the UK government, of the UK government brought by Compassionate World Farming in 2003. Now, they challenged government policy which permitted the use of fast-growing genotypes that inevitably caused chronic hunger. Because on the face of it, it seemed to breach the bans in UK and European law on unnecessary suffering. The point is, they could use slower growing strains in order to overcome this problem. That's all they would have to do to prevent breeders being forced to be chronically hungry for most of their lives. Now, these are the relevant clauses up here you've got some of the relevant clauses in the European law at the time, which was Council Directive 9858. So that kind of paraphrases that there. I won't read it out to save time. The implementing regulations that the UK brought in, which was the Welfare of Farmed Animals, England Regulations 2000, so apologies, some of this only partially applies to Scotland, or this may have applied at the time, but things are probably fairly similar here. So the UK implementing regulations placed a burden on owners and keepers of animals to take all reasonable steps to ensure that the conditions under which animals are bred or kept comply with the requirements. And animals are required to be given sufficient food to promote a positive state of well-being. Now, Compassionate World Farming argued the only way to comply with the law is to avoid rearing birds, fast-growing birds, and to instead use birds of slower-growing birds with different genotypes. And this was an example of where the English courts have had to consider the yawning gap between the consensus that animals shouldn't be caused to suffer unnecessarily, and the continued existence of intensive farming systems that unavoidably have a detrimental impact on animal welfare compared with alternative non-intensive methods. However, I mean, it seems like an open and shut case, to be honest, but looking at the two judgments in the High Court and the Appeal Court, both of them sided with the government and rejected Compassion's application in a surprising and significant way. Now, first of all, the European directive, as with most directives dealing with animal welfare, they include requirements that bring in scientific value judgments, such as wholesome diet, appropriate care. Now, it appears that in the UK, case law has developed such that the room for discretionary judgment in applying these terms has led judges to be wary of interpreting these as strict obligations. Thus, they've created a situation where the government can legally require industries to take reasonable steps to meet these requirements rather than actually meet them. This effectively shifts power from Parliament and the formulators of regulations to industry. Despite the scientific evidence of chronic hunger, which was based on the big European Commission report in 2000, and hence the intrinsic risk and existence of distress in the animals, both courts managed to reject this as a sufficient grounds for ruling government policy unlawful, partly by accepting some of the kind of the questioning the government industry brought in their court submissions, the question, the science. Or basically, what they were able to do is, if they could cast a little bit of doubt on the inference that chronic hunger caused distress, basically that was enough to persuade the judges to, you don't have to, you know, we'll side with the government on this. However, there was actually a more basic reason underpinning the judiciary's rejection of the judicial review. They explicitly refused to even consider the possibility that the rearing of fast-growing genotypes was not permitted by the legislation, which was, of course, the fundamental contention of Compassion's application. And from this position, they inevitably went on to find that the restrictive feeding regime was not incompatible with the law, as a balance had to be arrived between mutually incompatible welfare concerns. So the promotion of an animal's well-being required a balancing of factors which may conflict, but no actual strict discrete obligation. The obligation was to take all reasonable steps and to promote. And the government and the judge held that performing the balancing itself met the requirements imposed by the directive. And the upshot of this is that the rule of law in this instance is fundamentally undermined, because its interpretation becomes entirely conditional on institutionalised practices, regardless of whether those institutionalised practices are compatible with the letter of the law. The industry's selective breeding and genetic engineering of animals is allowed to erode the minimum animal welfare standards that the community law has laid down. Now, briefly going, there was another directive in 2007 which was again implemented into UK legislation in 2010. Again, the government rejected the animal welfare groups' representations based on scientific evidence. One of the big things was that the European Union Scientific Committee in this area said that as soon as you go above 30 kilograms of bird per square metre, that the welfare problems go up clearly quite quickly there. But the government rejected it and said, no, we're not going to gold plate the directive. We're going to go with the lowest standards that we can possibly get away with. And since May 10 with the new coalition government, if anything, there's been a further shift in power towards producers. The Treasury Green Book, which DEFRA used to kind of guide how they implement the directive, uses a particular economic argument when they're dealing with animal welfare issues. And basically, the problem is when the government considers animal welfare in policymaking, they don't actually consider it directly. They only consider it in terms of benefits it provides to people who care about animals. And the government is now actually going to the point where they're not going to write the codes of practice themselves, they're actually asking industry to write them, which gets us back to the when's the next BSE going to happen. There's also been the Farm Animal Welfare Council has also criticised the government for secrecy, saying that basically this is a massive problem because consumers aren't aware of what's happening to birds and what their options are to buy birds that are raised in less cruel systems, that secrecy is preventing the public being able to kind of exercise what it would appear they would like to do, which is buy from less intensive systems, but the lack of information scuppers that. And also, obviously, it scuppers accountability of government policy as well. So if we kind of summarise the policy network here, the broiler policy network in the UK, the outcomes consistently favour industry over animal welfare. The government consistently sides with industry over both policy formulation and implementation. UK transposition of EU directives tends to kind of weaken the welfare provisions because the way they're interpreted is watered down in terms of the not strict obligations. So it's a very strong indicator of a network which is elitist and exclusive, and a quite strong sort of policy community type of network. And we can see how the policy community also seeks to maintain homeostasis through its interaction with its macro level context. So public opinion is resisted through a combination of strict sounding regulations, but secrecy which hides the true nature of their lack of implementation. And you can see why this tactic is adopted by industry, because the most significant impact on the industry has come through external media coverage and public concern in the late 2000s. So, for example, Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall's Chicken Out programme. That's had more impact than anything the government's done, basically. Okay, we'll go on to New Zealand's policy. One of the interesting things about not just New Zealand, but lots of countries, is they all claim to have the strictest animal welfare regulations in the world, and obviously they can't all be right, but it's an interesting tactic that you see, it's very common. And also, I think New Zealand, the headline legislation does look quite progressive. So the 1999 Animal Welfare Act there appears to require the protection of the five freedoms. That's freedom from hunger and thirst, freedom from discomfort, freedom from pain, injury or disease, freedom to express normal behaviour, and freedom from fear and distress. Which, on the face of it, you think that's compared to what actually happens in most places, that's quite a progressive approach. Now, funny enough, despite this, industry practice is broadly similar to the UK, and maximum legal stocking density is 38 kilograms per square metre, as in the UK it can be 39. Michael Morris, who's a researcher in New Zealand, he's done some of the analysis here through Freedom of Information applications, etc. And he's argued on the basis that if the provisions of the Animal Welfare Act were consistently applied to farms, most agricultural practices that are taken for granted wouldn't be allowed. And this would include intensive broiler farming operations, where it's quite clear that hens cannot display normal patterns of behaviour, besides a lot more. So how has this situation evolved? Well, the Animal Welfare Act mandates the issue of more detailed and specific codes of practice for various sectors, such as meat, chickens, pigs, layers, etc. And farmers must comply with the codes of practice. And the codes of practice are supposed to comply with the Animal Welfare Act's guarantee of the five freedoms. There is, however, as there often is in legislation dealing with animal welfare, a broad range of exceptional circumstances, derogations. Also, as is often the case, the definition of these circumstances is pretty wide. So it includes feasibility, practicality, and economic effects of any transition from intensive practices to less intensive practices. And as Morris has observed, this provision could theoretically excuse producers from any obligations to their animals, since it can always be argued that any improvements in animal welfare will result in increasing costs to producers, and that counts as an exceptional circumstance not to do it. Now, at the time of the Animal Welfare Act, the Select Committee of the New Zealand Parliament that was looking at this was sensitive to the need to prevent this derogation, effectively allowing a free-for-all. And one of the areas of concern they specifically highlighted was intensive broiler farming. Nonetheless, Morris concludes that in practice, the Animal Welfare Act hasn't made any significant difference to animal welfare in this area. Now, I mentioned the issue of path dependency earlier, and one of the things that's interesting when you look at this is actually the Animal Welfare Act was initiated by farmers in New Zealand and not the animal welfare organisations. And that's because when you read it, when you look into it, they and the government see animal welfare as an export marketing issue rather than an issue of intrinsic importance. And one of the problems here is that the this area of policy is run by the Ministry for Primary Industries in New Zealand. And as the name suggests, that ministry's job is to lead and facilitate, to maximise productivity and efficiency of New Zealand's primary industries, agriculture being a major one of them. So on the one hand, they're dedicated to supporting the interests of farmers, but at the same time, they're supposed to be the ones that are guarding animal welfare. So there's a clear conflict of interest here. And I'll give you an example of, I've just been looking at the minutes of the advisory committee here, and they had a visit from the minister at the last meeting. And he told them he anticipates that animal welfare issues will only heighten over time, and that he considers the committee very important to him and the ministry in maintaining New Zealand's reputation, which is, I say, it's quite an interesting indicator of their priorities. So in New Zealand, the codes of practice are developed by something called the National Animal Welfare Advisory Committee, or the NAWAC. So they write them, and then they're signed off by the minister. The secretariat, it's supposed to be independent, but the secretariat is supplied by the Ministry for Primary Industry. So how does this formulation process work? Well, the process is claimed to be open by industry because of the requirement for public announcement of codes, the requirement to consider public submissions, and the powers to consult with interesting parties. Now, my observation of this is these are all discretionary powers. How they're exercised will depend on which interests dominate the process. Considering public submissions is not the same as being forced to actually take specific account of them. How are we doing for time, Erica?
You've got just over 5 minutes.
All right, cool. Not too far off now. Now, the NAWAC, the committee is dominated by industry, and thus economic considerations almost always are allowed to outweigh animal protection considerations. Another interesting thing is the way that they try to organise out public opinion from this process. Basically, what they do is they kind of make a contrast between kind of short-term public opinion and then societal expectations. So they can dismiss public opinion as a kind of capricious reaction to something that's just turned up in the media, which has happened quite a few times in New Zealand, actually. And that's the way they can kind of, that's how they excuse ignoring public opinion. The interpretation of science is quite interesting. It tends to have quite a kind of behavioralist element to it. There's a reluctance to acknowledge the mental states of animals. And there's quite a blatant cherry picking of evidence. So, you know, if there's a scientific peer-reviewed published study that would perhaps indicate a need for change, they will go back to kind of anecdotal evidence in New Zealand, perhaps, and rely on that rather than the stricter, the better science. So the new there's a new code of practice that NAWAC have just issued for meat chickens, just issued last year. And then one of the interesting things here is, despite all the evidence of the problems with fast-growing genotypes, they've basically sidelined that as an issue. So it's almost been organised off the political agenda in New Zealand. And I think this is related to the oligopolistic structure of the broiler industry in New Zealand, which is dominated by fast-growing breeds. And also it's been suggested to me that because of New Zealand's geographical isolation, small market and strict quarantine conditions, there is a problem with importing eggs of slow-growing breeds into the country. Now, how economically difficult that really is something I need to look into a bit more. Similar on stocking density, the committee have tried to sort of weaken the need for change there by saying, oh, they're only at maximum stocking density for a short period at the end of the grow-out period. But as I mentioned earlier, it doesn't happen just then, but also, I think New Zealand, this happens even more than the UK. You have this thinning process where the density goes up very high at 3 weeks before a proportion of the animals are killed. So NAWAC therefore concludes that New Zealand standards regarding stocking density are appropriate as long as environmental conditions are taken into consideration. The industry and government tend to construct animal welfare in terms consistent with their economic interests, such as health, animal health and productivity, rather than the subjective experience of the animals themselves. However, just this week, a massive new report into lameness in New Zealand broilers has been published, and they've not been able to get around the fact that the evidence shows that lameness has got worse in the last 6 years, 6 or 7 years. So it may be the case that the build-up of scientific evidence on this issue is getting to the point where it's harder to deny it while maintaining some credibility. Okay, so we'll just go through the conclusion as quickly as possible. The New Zealand policy community is more directly dismissive of dominant scientific findings. Now, the second point is an interesting thing I've read in connection with in a different policy area, and it's also something I've experienced as I do a little bit of work in Ireland, is that the very fact that it's a much smaller country in terms of human population means that the interactions between the people interested in this area are a lot more intense. Kind of everyone knows each other. And I just wonder whether it's the case that it's easy to kind of maintain a factually dubious discourse amongst a more tightly integrated group of people. I mean, one of the interesting things is that from what I can see, the New Zealand RSPC have a fundamentally different understanding of the welfare impacts of genotype compared to the UK RSPCA, and it's going to be interesting to see what they say when I go back to them and point this out. I think the other thing with New Zealand is that farming is, there's a kind of mythological status in New Zealand for farming, because historically agriculture has been a huge proportion of the New Zealand economy, and farmers are seen as almost building New Zealand as a nation. Now, in the UK, industry dominance of policy is achieved through a deeper, more subtle paradigm and set of power structures that prioritises economic interests over animal welfare. So I think a lot of this is, in the UK, it's more kind of groupthink, and the historical entrenchment of certain interests is more powerful than others. So, I gave you the example, what they tend to do is, rather than outright denial of scientific evidence, they just cast enough doubt on it to persuade judges, politicians to think, no, we shouldn't act now, we'll wait. And I mean, the tobacco labelling thing has been a classic example of that. I mean, everyone's seen Yes Minister, I guess. So you can see they're usually not quite that blatant, but they're very skilled at getting what they want without necessarily appearing to be quite so ruthless. So broadly speaking, I think in both the UK, I mean, these are kind of tentative conclusions at the moment because this is ongoing research, but to actually get around this impasse, openness is clearly an important value to enhance. So people, in a democratic society, we need to have information so we as a public can understand and have input into the policy process. And obviously that's connected with accountability, so that the government is then receptive to public opinion rather than always managing to avoid it. Independence of the policymaking processes is critical. That's absolutely critical. And that needs to be enshrined in law. For example, any act in the UK or New Zealand should specify what the composition of these advisory committees is. And lastly, I think, and this comes to, in a sense, the bigger agenda of the Centre for Animals and Social Justice. Because if in your policy network it comes down to a raw power battle, basically industry is going to win 99 times out of 100 at that level. So what you need is something at the macro level that enshrines a pluralistic power structure at the policy network level, so it doesn't just all come back to a kind of law of the jungle process. So constitutional protections which say you have to consider animal welfare in impact assessments and define that somehow. Bodies within government who are solely devoted to speaking up for animals, they don't have any conflict of interest in terms of supporting industry. And perhaps, there are perhaps other laws and other constitutional methods that can be adopted in both countries to start to overcome some of these quite serious ethical and democratic failures. I think that's probably about me for time, and I've covered most of what I intended to say. So thanks very much, and hope that was interesting. And there's some references for you as well. So if you want any more, just let me know. Thanks.